Well, good morning, everybody. Thank you very much for your attendance this morning. I hope that you find this session as interesting and hopefully as entertaining as previous sessions have been at the Global Strategy Forum. We have on the panel this morning a brace of Scots, Liam Fox, who really needs no introduction but was Secretary of State for Defence and recently made given a very interesting speech about our relationship with Europe. On my immediate right is Malcolm Chalmers, who again I think needs a little introduction these days. Malcolm is now Research Director and Director UK Defence Policy at RUSI, had a very distinguished academic career before that, with an interlude working as my specialist policy advisor and then working for Margaret Beckett after me. And so two Scots and two Englishmen. Peter Jenkins, who was in the British diplomatic service and in the particular context of this meeting, was the permanent representative to the IAEA in Vienna, and I had much to do with him and was extremely grateful for his expert advice and guidance when I was handling the Iran dossier on behalf of the British government for the 5 years that I was Foreign Secretary. I'm going to invite our panel to speak in the order of the table from your right to left. So I will start with Liam and then Malcolm and then Peter. If I may, so that we can leave ourselves time for sort of 25 minutes questions, I'll ask each speaker to speak for 10 minutes and then gently nudge them. And then there'll be an opportunity for questions, and we always aim to finish almost bang on at 2 o'clock. Thank you very much. So, first of all, Liam.
Who is John Soup from?
It's probably better if you stand, actually, Liam. But as you wish. Most politicians can't sit and speak at the same time. but Liam may be an exception.
Okay. Then that should be fine. I thought I'd just begin with some general remarks that might open up the debate. And my first thought when I saw the title was, how real is the threat? And my question was, what threat are we talking about? I think there are really two. I think there's the one that's uppermost in people's mind, which is the threat of Iran's nuclear program, which I think concentrates most minds. But I also think, especially if you're in the region, what you get a very strong feeling for is Iran's neighbours feeling that there is a threat of Iran's desire for regional hegemony for a number of reasons. And these two things are often conflated, I think, by the West. I think that we need to try to separate them out a little bit. I also think that the West tends to, and by that I particularly mean the United States, tends to see events in Iran through a religious prism. They tend to see it as part of a Sunni-Shia struggle, and I think they fail to often understand the strength of what, for shorthand, I will call Persian nationalism as an influence in the wider thinking and a driver behind Iranian policy. And I think that before we try to understand the threat, we try to understand where the Iranians come from and how they see us, as well as how we see them. And I think the first thing that I would say is that the Iranians really do believe that they have been slighted by the colonial powers for a very long time, that they've been very badly treated for the country that they believe themselves to be, that they've been insulted over a long period of time and have a desire to create a better equilibrium. I think they believe they have a very proud history and culture which is not respected by many countries in the West, and a complex history that is not properly understood. I also think that they have certainly more than a touch of superiority when it comes to dealing with their neighbours in the region, who they regard as rather vulgar newcomers compared to themselves with their much richer cultural history. I think we also have to understand the difference between the regime and the people. Our quarrel at the moment is with the regime in Iran, not the people of Iran, and certainly my own experience from visiting Iran was that people I met on the street were much more pro-West in their attitudes and even their dress than the leadership could remotely represent. I think we also need to understand the demographics of Iran, the fact that there is a huge young population that sooner or later will be the influential grouping rather than the small and aging group of religious leaders that they have at the present time. I don't think that we understand the opposition in Iran. I don't think we've got sufficient intelligence about what is actually happening on the ground. I think that we still confuse the real opposition with the Green Movement. The Green Movement was, in many ways, with Khatami and others, a watered-down, slightly more Western-friendly version of the rest of the regime, and not something that was fundamentally different. That's probably a... Cyber warfare gets everywhere these days.
I think we'll come out here. Unplug it.
That's high tech solution.
Done. So I did it.
Right. I also think that we had a strategic failure in 2009 at what I would still describe as the stolen election to support morally the Green Movement. And I would contrast that with our support for Lech Walesa and Solidarity before the fall of the Soviet Union, because at that time, by giving our support to Solidarity, we created internal pressure on the regime as well as the external pressure that the NATO powers were able to create. We've now, by our lack of support for the Green Movement, or even lack of moral support for the Green Movement, left ourselves as a one-trick pony, only able to exercise external power on a country that, frankly, the leaders don't give a damn about international opinion. And that makes life very difficult for ourselves and potentially leads us into an outcome cul-de-sac of either Iran with a bomb or a bombed Iran, neither of which, in my view, are in our national interests to see in anything like timescales envisaged. When it comes to the threat from the regime, I think we need to understand one person above all else, and that is Khamenei himself. And if you look back, and those of you who are interested, there's a very short book by Karim Sanjapur from the Carnegie Endowment for Peace, which is called Reading Khamenei, and it basically sets out his speeches, writings over 30 years, and there's not a jot of difference, not a comma's difference over 30 years about the purity of the Islamic Revolution and the danger of external culture, as someone put it, fearing McDonald's more than Mossad. There is the idea of contempt for the existence of the State of Israel and an utter hatred for the United States. And those things have not changed. And I think we also need to, in terms of threat assessment, be looking at whether the revolution is still evolving in Iran, whether Iran is now moving away from a totally religious model of their revolution, and whether it's an increasingly militarized state under the supreme leader, mediated through the IRGC. In terms of the other threats, the regional threats, where Iran is using proxies to further its foreign policy and other interests through whether it's Hezbollah, whether it's Hamas. Last month, Turkey intercepted two shipments from Iran. One was bound to Syria, one was bound for the Taliban. The deputy foreign minister has said in Tehran that they won't move one iota on Syria and will continue to support them economically and politically. And another area where Iranian influence is perhaps being overlooked very often, especially in Europe, is in the Americas. Syrian news agencies have talked openly about Hezbollah cells in South America. Ahmadinejad's visited the region 6 times in 6 years. In November, Mitt Romney, one of the presidential candidates, was asked what wasn't getting enough attention in the American foreign policy, and he said Hezbollah in Central America. And in March this year, the chief of Southern Command briefed the Senate Armed Services Committee on Iranian-backed activity in South America. Very little of that gets into our press for reasons I don't quite understand, but it's certainly gaining ground and traction in the United States. On the nuclear threat itself, whether the Iranians are a nasty regime, whether they pose a threat to their regional neighbours directly or indirectly, pale into insignificance on the nuclear proliferation question. If Iran becomes a nuclear weapon state, we will have a new nuclear arms race in the world's most unstable region. because if Iran becomes a nuclear weapon state, you can bet your bottom dollar Saudi and Turkey follow in short order, and with the potential for others to come. And I would have thought that after all the trouble we went to at the end of the Cold War to prevent proliferation, the last thing we wanted to give the next generation as our legacy was a nuclear arms race in the Middle East and the Gulf. Iran, we know, is working on delivery mechanisms and improving technology and being given a lot of help from other countries. And their rejection of the Russian proposals over their civil nuclear program, in other words, to supply them with the fuel and then take away the spent fuel, was for me all the confirmation we needed that this was not about a civil nuclear program. This is about the ability to develop nuclear weapons in the longer term. Now, what are, in terms of the threat, are the responses we're likely to see? Well, I think the Israeli view is different from the American view, both in time scale. I think the Israelis think in terms of 12 months, the Americans think in terms of 24 months, or something of that order. I think the Americans see it as a regional threat. Israel sees it as an existential threat, and these are very different things. And when people say, the Israelis overreact, all I would say is this. There are enough people alive in Israel today to remember the last time someone said, we're going to wipe you out, and tried to do so. And so the view from Jerusalem is different from the view that is taken anywhere else, and we have to try to factor that into our thinking and understanding of the wider issues. But the biggest threat of all, more than any of the things that I've set out so far, is miscalculation. A rise in tension, and on a hot day in the Gulf, someone in the IRGCN, who's had a bad day at home, takes a pot shot at an American ship, is the most likely way that we stumble into any sort of crisis in Iran or the region. And that, I think, is the thing that we should worry about most, not least because it's a thing that we can control least.
Thank you very much.
What do you want me to do?
I just speak. You're an academic. You'll be heard at the back. Malcolm, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Jack.
You're spot on time as well.
It's an apposite time to be discussing this issue today because the E3+3 negotiators are talking to the Iranians in Istanbul. But any time in the last decade or more would have been a good time to talk about this topic. I had the privilege, as Jack said, of working for him for a brief period when he was Foreign Secretary, and Iran was at the top of his agenda then, and all the terms which we're all so familiar with today in terms of what could make a deal and Iran's enrichment program and the role of the IAEA and the additional protocol and so on and so forth were all things that were very lively issues back then. The fact that this issue has been going on for so long has reminded me of a quote which my colleague Shashank Joshi from RUSI, who's writing a paper on this subject, had in a paper he's writing from a 1992 CIA report, which said, quote, Iran is making progress in the nuclear arms program and could develop a nuclear weapon by 2000. Now, that clearly hasn't happened. It's not a reason to presuppose it won't happen. And I think things are very worrying indeed. But what I think it does say to us, a very important message, is that we should be prepared as analysts, perhaps it's easier for analysts to do this, to acknowledge uncertainty when we don't know exactly what's happening, and factor that into our decision-making. And in foreign policy crises of the last decade, whether it's Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, or Syria, one of the most difficult things for policymakers is they don't know what will happen if they push a particular lever. There's a balance of probabilities. And it's made even worse if you don't actually know what you're responding to in detail. And therefore, what I want to do in my talk is really highlight what it seems to me are three of the key uncertainties in the debate about Iran's nuclear program, and maybe say a few words about what that suggests for policy. The first uncertainty, of course, is in relation to what Iran's real intentions are, if indeed there is a unified sense of intention within
the Iranian regime.
Is it seeking purely to demonstrate prowess in this technology as a proud developing country with a long history, which most reports suggest suspended at least most of its nuclear weapon program in 2003? Has it not yet decided whether to go all the way to weaponization at the earliest possible opportunity, but is holding that option open, as US published intelligence estimates seem to suggest? Or is this all a ploy, and Iran is simply looking for the first possible opportunity to break out, to test, to leave the NPT and to become a nuclear arms state in the same way that Pakistan and India are? And it may be, perhaps the most likely explanation is they simply haven't yet decided, in which case a central aim of policy has to be persuade the Iranians by one means or another not to take that decision, not to cross over the threshold, even if it's not possible to roll back everything they have developed already. What I think I would say is it does make a real difference whether Iran is a nuclear weapon state or a nuclear weapon capable state. Sometimes people suggest that they're so far advanced that it really doesn't make any difference. It does make a real difference in crisis stability whether you're facing a state that has an operational nuclear weapon or one that could only build one with 6 months or a year's notice, because the latter is not much use if a sudden crisis arises in Lebanon or Syria or whatever, in which Iran feels nuclear weapons would provide a role. Of course, it's quite possible we don't know. We don't know which of those categories Iran is in now, and as their program develops, it may become more difficult to do so. But uncertainty there, I think, is critical. The second and third uncertainties really relate to what a nuclear Iran would be like, how it would behave were it to acquire nuclear weapons. And the second uncertainty relates to the impact of an Iranian nuclear weapon on onward proliferation, and Dr. Fox already touched on this. Clearly the departure of Iran from the NPT and its explosion of a nuclear weapon would damage the NPT as a global regime. The regime has survived the defection of North Korea, but could it survive another defection, or would others in other continents start seeing the erosion of this norm and countries like Brazil or South Africa or Indonesia or Nigeria start thinking about their own options, believing that this universal norm had not been, had failed? Or would regional nuclear weapon-free zones in places like Africa and South America still play a very important non-proliferation role? We don't know. But clearly the biggest issue would be in relation to Iran's immediate neighbours. And we have some history on this. Israel's undeclared nuclear programme, introduced in 1966-67, was widely seen as playing some role in contributing to the peace after 1973 between Israel and its Arab neighbours. But it may also have played some role, I don't think the most important role, but it may have also played some role in encouraging Iraq, Libya and Syria to go down a nuclear weapon route themselves. A nuclear route, of course, which was stopped stopped by military action by Israel and indeed by the United States and also by the deal that was struck by with Libya after 2003. But whether or not that's the case, and nuclear proliferation in the Middle East is therefore not a new phenomenon, it's something that's been with us for some time, whether or not that is the case, there was some knock-on effect in relation to those states. It will be much harder for the international community to stop Egypt, Saudi Arabia or Turkey from acquiring nuclear weapons if they decide to do so than it was for much weaker states like Iraq, Syria and Libya. These are countries all with strong economies and all with very considerable and relatively good links to the broader international community. They're not rogue states in the sense that the states I mentioned earlier were. But those very features, their internal resilience and their strong international relationships, may make it somewhat less likely that they will automatically decide to nuclearise in the wake of an Iranian decision. The biggest risk, I think, is in relation to Saudi Arabia. But in the case of Saudi Arabia, because of its particular relationship with Iran and its proximity to Iran, but the biggest risk for the biggest difficulty Saudi would have is that its indigenous capability for building such capabilities is pretty limited, and certainly most commentators, most assessments suggest that they would have to have external assistance, most of all from Pakistan, in doing so. And I don't think we should take it for granted such assistance would be forthcoming. Certainly, I think it's the case that whether or not there was honor of proliferation, particularly in the case of Saudi Arabia, would depend critically on the signals that the international community is sending out to Saudi Arabia or other potential proliferators about such a scenario. And here I think we are, in the United Kingdom and some of our allies, in danger of sending out the wrong message. We're in danger of saying that, as a foreign secretary has done, as Dr. Fox has done, that it's inevitable that there would be armed proliferation in the case of Iran acquiring any sort of nuclear capabilities. And it's a danger that might be read, although it's not intended, it might be read as saying it's acceptable for there to be armed proliferation were Iran to acquire her weapons. Rather than, I think, sending the message which the United States sent to Taiwan and South Korea and Japan after the acquisition of nuclear weapons by China, which is that we are your allies, we'll stick with you, there will be extended deterrent guarantees to you, and the best way to contain the Iranian threat is not for everybody to become nuclear, because if other states become nuclear, then the whole basis of a sanctions regime against Iran falls down. How can you have sanctions on Iran because of its nuclear program if Saudi Arabia and Turkey also have nuclear weapons? It's just not possible. You can't have sanctions against Saudi Arabia for rather obvious reasons. So the only circumstances in which a containment policy post an Iranian test can work is when the other states in the region make it clear that they will stick to their NPT commitments. That doesn't mean that they will do so. I'm not for a moment suggesting that the risk of armed proliferation is not increased. Clear it is, but nor is it inevitable, I would suggest. And that really brings me to the third and final uncertainty. And that's whether and to what extent Iranian bomb would make it less risk-averse in regional crisis through its ability to adopt what I sometimes heard described as an approach of aggressive sanctuarization. In other words, its nuclear force would certainly make it much less vulnerable to nuclear attack by others. It would make that an incredible threat, an incredible threat anyway. But it might also, I think it would also, deter others from launching regime-changing attacks of the sort we saw launched against Libya by NATO. The question mark, I think, is how far an Iranian nuclear weapon could allow it to achieve less existential objectives. Could an Iranian nuclear weapon allow it to pursue its objectives more effectively in Syria or Lebanon? Does that require it to have some implicit extended deterrence to Hezbollah or Assad? And here I think it's becoming much less credible. Certainly the historical record is that nuclear weapon states have struggled to give nuclear weapons a broader role simply because in order to do so it requires disproportionate threats which are disproportionate to the objective being obtained. And indeed, I suspect certainly a question mark about whether an Iranian bomb would even be able to deter limited attacks on its own territory. For example, the assassination campaigns that have been going on against Iranian nuclear scientists, would possession of Iranian nuclear bomb mean that whoever is responsible for those attacks would be deterred from carrying them out? I don't think so, because it's not proportionate. And importantly for Iran, while it has significant capabilities for assistance to non-state actors, and certainly there's no reason to suppose that assistance would decline in the event of nuclearization, its conventional warfighting capabilities are pretty limited, and that limits, I think, its wider options. So, but But there's no doubt that in that situation, ambiguity on red line, on those circumstances in which Iran would seriously threaten the use of nuclear weapons, ambiguity on Iran's red lines and others' red lines would, as Dr. Fox rightly said, but also in a post-nuclear context, lead to real risks of miscalculation by one country or another. And therefore, an Iranian nuclear weapon would pose a real threat to regional security, something we need to work very hard to avoid. But, and this is the last 2 points I would make very briefly. First of all, I think the sanctions program is a very worthwhile one. It is making a difference to Iranian calculus. But at some stage in the process, the countries imposing those sanctions have to be prepared to trade them for something. And there has to be a difficult discussion about what that trade will be. And maybe not at that stage yet, but we could be in the relative near future, and maybe we need to discuss that further. I'm happy to come back to that in questions. And the second concluding remark I would make is that I believe a military attack on Iranian nuclear facilities by either Israel or the United States, while Iran still keeps its nuclear facilities under IAEA safeguards and has not said that it is acquiring nuclear weapons, so that the current situation would be very difficult to explain to the wider international community. It's another matter if Iran breaks out. But while Iran is still constrained, or at least to a degree transparent because of those safeguards, I think an attack is... The danger is an attack of that sort could do more to precipitate Iran moving decisively into the militarized route rather than preventing it doing so. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed. And now Peter. Thank you.
Thank you. I have a lot that I want to say in just 10 minutes, so I must ask you to forgive me. I'm going to read from a prepared text in order to avoid spending time searching for the right words. It does take me time to do that. I want to offer you a contrarian view, a non-conformist view. When I was serving in Vienna, I was convinced that Iran's leaders were intent on acquiring nuclear weapons, and I saw that as a threat to one of the most important pillars of the international order, the nuclear non-proliferation regime. So I thought the West was right to try and avoid that happening by denying Iran an enrichment capability. But since 2007, I've come to believe that Iran's decision-making is based on cost-benefit considerations. And I've come to see that those considerations, for the time being at least, have led Iran's leaders to think better of acquiring nuclear weapons. And because of that, I believe that the current Western policy, essentially unchanged since 2003, we're still trying to deny Iran an enrichment capability. I've come to believe that that policy is misguided. And it's really that collection of propositions that I would like to try and explain and justify to you now. In late 2007, the American intelligence community, Malcolm referred to this, came up with an assessment. The key sentences read, "We judge with high confidence that in fall 2003, Tehran halted its nuclear weapons program, but that it is keeping open the option to develop nuclear weapons." It so happens that public statements from Russian leaders and a leak to the Israeli press earlier this year suggest that the Russian and Israeli intelligence assessment is just the same. Essentially, what we're getting from these intelligence assessments and from the IAEA is a picture of a country that's trying to put together the wherewithal to make a nuclear weapon, but that has not decided to do so. Instead, in fact, it downsized its goal from acquiring weapons to the acquisition of the wherewithal to produce weapons. This latter option is not outlawed by the NPT. US officials have long known that it is possible for an NPT party to achieve nuclear pregnancy, as they dubbed it back in 1968, without violating the treaty. And the treaty's withdrawal provisions actually only make sense on that basis. If one tries to imagine the situation from the other side of the hill, as good generals are wont to do, then this assessment looks all the more credible. Iran's leaders have little incentive to go beyond acquiring a latent capability, and several very good reasons not to take such a risky step. A recent head of US Strategic Command observed that when a threat assessment changes, the strategic posture should also change. But in this case, the Iranian threat assessment changed at the end of 2007, but the West policy has not changed. It remains to deprive Iran of an enrichment capability, even though this is no longer strictly necessary. This leads to Western tactics that are widely seen outside the West as unjust. Iran has not been in non-compliance with its NPT obligations since its IAEA safeguards failures were corrected in the course of 2004. Those safeguards failures were significant, but much less serious than those of Iraq, Prat in 1991, or North Korea in 2002-03. Yet thanks to Western efforts and contrivance, the Security Council has adopted 5 resolutions under Chapter 7, creating so-called international obligations for Iran and imposing sanctions. This is seen outside the West as disproportionate, a disproportionate response to Iran's long since passed non-compliance, aggravated by the fact that none of these Chapter 7 resolutions has been justified by an explicit determination that Iran's nuclear activities represent a threat to peace and security. Some of you may think that justice has no place in international affairs. If so, I would ask you to reflect on the idea that declining powers have much to gain from a strong international order based on respect for international law. I sense that this is what President Clinton had in mind when he observed that the United States had 20 years to create an international order in which the US could feel secure once it had ceased to be the sole superpower. Conversely, injustice impacts on soft power. It saddened me in Vienna to see how the UK and France lost the moral authority they enjoyed in the IAEA board in 2003 by insisting that Iran prolong indefinitely its suspension of enrichment. At worst, by applying a double standard to Iran, we bred cynicism in relation to the very regime that we claim to be defending. Incidentally, Iranians crave justice. Divine justice is central to Shia, though not to Sunni, religious beliefs, and Zoroastrianism foreshadowed Christianity by positing a divine judge who determined the deserts of souls of the souls of the dead. Western policy is also misguided in that it risks aggravating the threat it seeks to address. I won't try your patience by speculating about whether Western sanctions will achieve their purpose, although my reading of Iranian sense of identity, conscious of their own worth and determined to reverse 300 years of decline, is that it will take many years for sanctions to cause Iran to capitulate. Instead, I want to make a simple point. Agreements imposed on a prostrate foe are unlikely to last. Machiavelli, patron saint of realists, once wrote, "I believe that forced agreements will be kept neither by princes nor by republics." History bears him out. Compare French reactions to the 1815 European settlement with their reactions to the settlement imposed on France by Germany in 1871. Compare German reactions to the 1925 Locarno treaties and the post-World War II settlement with German reactions to the treaty imposed on them at Versailles. My thesis is simply that a negotiated agreement can minimize the risk that Iran's leaders will be motivated to misuse their enrichment capabilities, whereas a forced agreement will give them a motive to proliferate. In the long run, it's motivation that counts, not capabilities. Americans are obsessed with prohibiting capabilities. Prohibition is in their culture. But prohibition can never be a lasting remedy. For the long term, one has to rely on influencing motivation. Brazil and Japan have much more extensive enrichment capabilities than Iran, and both have researched into nuclear weapons production, and yet we do not lie awake worrying about that, because we sense they lack the motive to want to do us harm. In the very few minutes, a couple of minutes at the most remaining to me, I just want to touch on three common objections to what I am advocating, which is essentially a deal based on the NPT, tolerating an Iranian enrichment capability in return for the best possible guarantees from Iran that none of its nuclear material will be diverted to military use. First objection is the claim that Iranians can't be trusted. Well, we used to say the same things about Soviet Russia, yet the West negotiated several agreements with the USSR that stood the test of time. A good agreement contains provision for verification, and verification over time conduces to the development of trust. Since the war, Iranians have honoured several agreements with the West, whereas pressure has failed to deliver what the West wanted on at least two occasions. Iran's leaders are not suicidal fanatics. They are rational actors. That's the view of the American intelligence community. And so they realise that a second betrayal of the trust of NPT parties would leave them and Iran friendless. The second objection is the Saudi factor. Saudi Arabia, we're told, cannot tolerate an Iranian enrichment capability. In my view, Saudi concerns are essentially expressions of rivalry. So helping Saudi Arabia to keep up with Iran is a solution to them. I suggest that Urenco supply Saudi Arabia and the UAE, which is currently building 4 nuclear power reactors, with an enrichment plant, under safeguards, of course, and with key technology black boxed. This can be the first of the multinational enrichment centres that the IAEA has been advocating. Hosting such a plant can do wonders for Saudi confidence. And finally, the Israeli factor. The Israeli angle is, of course, extremely complex. I only have time to say this. Israeli opinion concerning Iran is diverse. Only the other day, Israel's deputy foreign minister said that the unresolved Palestinian issue was a greater threat to Israel than Iran. Israeli military leaders do not believe it is necessary or desirable to attack Iranian nuclear facilities. A majority of the Israeli public is opposed to a go-it-alone Israeli strike. Israeli diplomats know that an attack on Iran would be a serious violation of the UN Charter. Another state's possession of a latent nuclear weapons capability does not add up to a self-defense justification. Moreover, prior to the end of the Cold War, Israelis used to shrug off Iranian vitriol and absurd threats emanating from Tehran. It was only in 1992 that Israeli Labour politicians decided that Iran could be useful to Israel as a strategic threat. In a recent exercise at the UK Defence Academy, in which I took part as an advisor monitor, the team playing the part of Israel ended up opening up a channel to Tehran with a view to arriving at a mutual non-aggression understanding. That's what Israel should be doing now, in my view. Thank you.
Thank you very much.